Okay, so that must have been an enormous relief.
That was our arrival in the great United States.
And then what transpired once you got the word that you were free to leave and come in to the country? What happened next?
Well, of course, that was as joyful and unexpected a surprise as was our retention in Ellis Island,
right.
A shock,
yeah.
In the first place. My uncle, well, we packed our hand baggage immediately and took a ferry back to New York. My uncle and his lawyer flagged down a cab, and we all got into the cab, and my uncle took us to a place in town where he had some business to take care of as long as he was in town. And he told us to wait in the cab while he and his lawyer went up into this building. I still remember very distinctly that we were sitting in the cab, still couldn't figure out what happened or why. And the cab driver got out of the cab and walked up the block to a store, I guess it was a supermarket of some sort, and came back with a bag of oranges, which he gave to us as a welcoming present in the United States. He, I guess, had been told by my uncle what we were here for. And I still remember many years later that this was our first welcoming mm-hmm. gift by this cab driver.
Wow.
So then later, when my uncle came back, they dropped us off at New York relatives' place. Meantime, my sister, who had gotten a job as a 16-year-old girl in New York and who had saved all the money that she made, which wasn't very much, until a year later when we arrived, she rented an apartment for us in the Bronx, and we now were able to get our furniture and everything moved into this apartment.
Mm.
And we moved in, and that was our first home
wow.
in the United States.
And can you remember any of your first impressions of in this country? Were there some things that struck you in particular as, I mean, everything was new, but...
Everything was new, and everything was kind of difficult because of the problem of communicating with people. I would say that was the most important difference.
Yeah.
Is there people spoke a different language.
Mm-hmm.
And we had to go shopping. We had to do all kinds of things without knowledge of the language. But fortunately, Yiddish is close enough to German so that people uh-huh. could communicate with us.
Mm-hmm.
With some difficulty, but we were able to get along.
So you had spoken German, but not Yiddish.
That's correct.
Uh-huh.
We did not. Oh, we had a few Jewish expressions, things like ganef and kela, and a few Hebrew words
mm-hmm.
mixed in with German when we were talking among ourselves. But our conversational language was definitely German,
mm-hmm.
the local dialect of German.
Right.
And we also in school learned the formal High German. But there was no English instruction in the school I went to. And what we learned from a couple of books that we bought was things like hello, goodbye, thank you, you're welcome,
mm-hmm.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5. That was about it. that yeah. was about the extent of our knowledge of English. Mm-hmm. So my parents, we arrived in May, and my parents immediately took me down to the local public school. They wanted me to get back into school immediately. That was one of their worries. I had been missing school since previous November. So it was just before the end of the school year, mm-hmm. and here I
started school.
Started school again. Mm-hmm. They went into the principal's office. I guess a neighbor of ours who had come from Germany went with us and acted as interpreter. And well, in those days, nowadays, most schools or big city schools have remedial courses, English as a second language, helping people who come from other countries. No such thing in those mm-hmm. days. The only concession they made was that they, well, I should have been finishing eighth grade at this time. They put me in 7A. Somehow they felt that by being with younger kids, I would learn English better than by being with kids of my age. I'm not sure what the reasoning was for that, but that's how they handled people from other countries, was to stick men with younger kids.
And how was that for you, going to school without the language? And
it was not a pleasant experience. The kids thought it was funny when I talked or when I couldn't understand what the teacher was saying, and they made fun of me at times, and they mimicked, and kids can be cruel that way. They mm-hmm. don't understand. At the same time, this motivated me to learn English as fast as possible, because I had to get out of this situation mm-hmm. of being laughed at and being mm-hmm. teased. Mm-hmm. So it didn't take me very long to learn English.
Mm-hmm. So you stayed in school for how long?
I stayed in school, well, I finished public school, skipped the term, fortunately, but was still behind my age group. Then came time to go to high school. My parents did not want me to get a job. They wanted me to concentrate on my studies, on learning.
Even though they themselves were working
They themselves were very
hard.
Very hard, very tough jobs, cleaning mm-hmm. jobs. Mm-hmm. My mother cleaned for various families, different days of the week. My father was a porter in a movie theater. But they wanted me to concentrate on schoolwork, and they saw this as the chance of getting our family back on its feet. And when I, as I finished public school, it was time to go to high school, and I ended up going to a very select high school in New York City, Bronx High School of Science, which requires entrance examinations, and only the top so many percent are admitted. Everybody was quite shocked to find out that this little refugee boy in PS 73 was now admitted to Bronx High School of Science.
And how did you feel when you were accepted?
This did wonders for my self-esteem. And I guess it probably horrified the kids that were not admitted to Bronx High School of Science, who had been making fun of me before that. Mm-hmm. So it was an important part of my return to self-confidence.
Would you say you were a How would you describe yourself, your kind of personality as a 14-year-old when you first came, before?
Oh, I was very timid. I was even in Germany. I guess that's one of the things that the Nazi propaganda did to me, was to kind of make me draw back into a shell. And I was not good at making friends or at interacting with other people, except for the people that I knew from mm-hmm. class and that I knew personally. So in Germany, I was the outsider because I was Jewish. In America, I was the outsider because I talked funny. And I guess some of the anti-German propaganda of prevalent in America at that time in response to Hitler's rule,
right.
Some of that was probably also projected to me by some of the kids. When America entered the war, after Pearl Harbor, after America was attacked, we became enemy aliens. We were officially classified and had to register as enemy aliens because we came from Germany. So the fact that we were persecuted in Germany at first did not make any difference to the American bureaucracy. Mm-hmm. We came from Germany, so we were enemy aliens. This created a bureaucratic problem, but most people knew why we were in America and why we had come from Germany. And it really didn't make that much difference later. Mm-hmm. After I finished high school, I became a member of the U.S. Army, registered for the draft, and after I passed my physical, I got to the point in the procedure where they had to inform me that since I was not an American citizen, I could not be forced to be in the United States Army. They could not draft me unless I agreed to being drafted. So they gave me this document waiving my rights as a foreign national, and I signed the waiver, and thereby became a member of the U.S. Army.
Did it occur to you that maybe you shouldn't sign it, that maybe, you know, you didn't have to serve, really?
You know, the war was still going on, and fighting in the war is not the most interesting, most enjoyable experience in the world. It's damn dangerous for a soldier. But on the other hand, I had better reason for fighting against Germany than any of the American people did, because I had experienced the hatred of the Nazi regime, whereas Americans had only read about it in the newspapers and heard about it on the radio. So to me, there was no choice. I had to. If I could stay out of the army, then what right did they have to draft all these American kids into the army? Mm-hmm.
And did you become a citizen then, once you signed up to go into the army?
Well, during basic training, I was taken to a courthouse, and I was given citizenship at that time. Mm-hmm. I guess it was about halfway through the basic training experience, and I became an American citizen. So I think a lot of the other GIs, of the other recruits, were intrigued by the idea of this man who was brought up in Germany now being trained to fight against Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And I was sent over to Europe just about the time the Allies entered Germany near the end of the war, and took part in the final drive across Germany at the end of the war, which I was very happy. Doesn't mean I wasn't scared,
mm-hmm.
but I was proud of the fact that I could now be part of this operation
mm-hmm.
of defeating the Nazi government.
Mm-hmm. And that, of course, is all written in your book, mm-hmm. which is entitled Escape and Return, and this was the return part.
That's right.
So how do you think your being in Germany towards the end of the war and after it, after the victory, how do you think that affected, or how did that influence your whole picture now of the, of what happened? I mean, in the beginning, you were really persecuted there, and then you come in as rescuer, in a sense.
In a sense, or a conqueror, or uh-huh. liberator.
Right.
The idea certainly appealed to me, and it certainly gave me a feeling of accomplishment, of gratitude, that I had the opportunity to close the loop, as it were,
mm-hmm.
and get back at the Nazi government. Particularly after the war was over, I was transferred into military government, and special branch of military government, that was the name of this department, which was concerned with denazification, with screening people for positions in the German government, positions with American Army units, positions in education and police force and so forth, to make sure that the same Nazis who had these positions before would not get back into the same jobs. It was only partly effective, successful in getting rid of the Nazis from those positions, but I think to the extent that it was successful, it was a very important step in post-war Germany. And it gave me a chance to interact with some pretty terrible Nazis.
Was there a feeling, I think it must be human nature, I mean, in a way you got revenge, in a certain sense.
In a way, yeah.
Revenge is has a negative, more of a negative sound than I think.
Yeah, well, you know, someone who, say, was in Auschwitz and was liberated at the end of the war must have had a horrible hatred of all things German, because his only contact with Germans was with the SS guards.
Oh.
And for them to hate all things German must have been a liberating feeling at the end of the war.
Mm-hmm.
I did not have this luxury. From my own experience, I knew that some Germans were very good people.
Mm-hmm.
Some Germans were horrible people. And I had to make the distinction between the two. I did not have the privilege of hating everything German, because some of my best friends as kids were Germans and remained my friends. And so revenge, I guess, retribution might be a better word.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
or selected punishment.
Why don't you mention some of the kinds of decisions that you personally had to make, which actually, of all kinds of people, you were perhaps the best to be in those decision-making positions because of what you just said. That you knew both sides, and so you really could weigh them.
Well, gave me the ability to write a book, for one thing. Mm-hmm. And there were occasions with my Army unit that I was assigned to initially, as well as during military government work, when I came across some perpetrators and some persecuted people and was able to distinguish between the two and treat them what I considered to be appropriately. I think I paid more attention to helping the survivors, even though that was done in my spare time rather than during duty. I paid more attention to helping the survivors than I did to punishing the guilty people. In military government, we had very specific rules of how to treat the Nazi activists. It was done strictly by organizational connections. If someone was a member of the Nazi Party during certain years, when it was a privilege to be a Nazi Party member, rather than duty, then that was punished. If you were an official in a Nazi organization, that was punished. What kind of punishment? First, lowest level, you didn't get the job you were applying for. A little higher level, your property would be seized, would be confiscated, and in many cases, handed over to the victims. In some cases, there was automatic arrest category. Members of the SS, members of the Gestapo, high officials of the party or of Nazi organizations were automatically arrested and for further investigation, for war crimes investigation. Now, when the war was still going on, I was with a company, with a unit, which our duty was to follow behind the armored column. The tanks would forge ahead into Germany, capture a city, and keep moving. And we would move in right behind them to the city and kind of clean up.
Which meant what?
Round up prisoners of war, move them to prisoners of war camp, restore normal functioning to the city in terms of putting out fires and renewing water and whatever else, food delivery and so forth. Get rid of the Nazi mayor and replace him with a, we didn't see many anti-Nazis, but at least a non-political person. And then this would take about 5 or 6 days. Then we would all pile onto our trucks and move on to the next city that had just been conquered by the armored column. And there were a number of security guard detachments like that. Mm-hmm. And we would sort of leapfrog. Mm-hmm. behind the armored columns. And in some cases, there were accusations of somebody had done something wrong. We would have to look into that quickly and arrest anyone who had been involved in that sort of thing. Not a thorough investigation. We would hand them over to military police or the CIC at that time, Counterintelligence Corps, and they would take it from there. So there was also a matter of handling the displaced persons. As we moved across Germany, there were millions of people who had been brought into Germany as forced laborers, as prisoners, and so on, who were now liberated. And they all wanted to go home, and of course they couldn't all go home. The streets were all clogged. Transportation wasn't available. So we helped to control and to register the flow of displaced persons, who were mostly allied nationals, but also people from Romania, Hungary, that were not considered allies. They were allies of Germany. So there were all kinds of complications, some things had to be done immediately, some things had to be put under control until they could be done later.
So, do you remember when you heard that the war was over?
Yes. We were in Weiden in Bavaria at that time. By that time, it was pretty obvious that the war was practically over. Mm-hmm. There were some units still fighting, and interestingly, some German army units in Czechoslovakia were still fighting when the German country was practically in Allied hands, and they were still fighting over there, but it was just a nominal attempt. They just didn't know when to quit. Because they were waiting for orders and such. But even before VE Day, it had become pretty obvious that the Germans, they had run all the way across the country and cut it in half. So what's left to fight for?
And so then what happened? How did your duties change then? Once victory was declared and you were still there in the army?
I ended up in Czechoslovakia, in what was the German-speaking part of Czechoslovakia, Sudetenland. And I was loaned out to the local government as sort of a liaison person between military and civilian government. The civilian administration was turned over to civilians, mostly Czech people. So I got a desk and a secretary and was real pleasant, very nice. Not much to do, just give people advice on who to see for their various problems and so on. So the army unit that I was with, the others that didn't have the language capability, they returned to more or less the camp type experience, where they had to stay put and get back to GI activities. But since I new German language, I got some more interesting jobs to do. There were, in our detachment of 50 people, there were three of us who could speak German. So obviously, we were kept pretty busy with our language. Although we also did patrols, walk patrols during the nights and during the days in the various places that we had just taken over. So we had military duties in addition to the translation and so on.
Well, we need to finish off here, but there's so much. Now that time has passed and you've written the book, which I want to say again is Escape and Return, and it is going to be in the Ellis Island Library for anyone interested. And but just the whole experience, time passing, and also the writing of the book, how does the whole experience set with you now at this point in time?
Well, people sometimes ask me, I became a speaker for the Holocaust Center of Pittsburgh and speak to many groups, mostly school groups. And they ask me sometimes, how has my experience affected my outlook, my attitudes, my personality? And I think that I am calmer in the face of crisis than most other people, much to the frustration of my wife, who gets upset about all kinds of things and gets upset because I don't get upset. But I had a job which involved some high stress responsibility, designing high pressure, high temperature equipment, and supervising the use of this equipment. And anytime something went wrong, there was always the possibility that something could blow up and kill a few people. So I tend not to fall apart under those conditions. I think there is a general feeling of, well, I went through all that and I got out of it okay. Whatever comes up, I'll be able to handle. Which may be illusory, it may not be realistic, but it's worked so far. I have many thoughts about how this could have happened in Germany, about human nature, about how German people acted and failed to act. And yes, I spend a lot of time thinking about that and observing people who are acting or failing to act in crises that are coming up nowadays. I guess I've become a little cynical about people and about their ideals and about their education and about the morals and how long they, what they will do to defend them. I'm grateful that I survived everything, that I avoided some of the worst events that other people were subjected to. I'm grateful that now at age 82, I'm still able to get around and remember things. So it's a mixture of optimism, skepticism, faith and realization that God doesn't punish or reward people. We have to do the rewarding and the punishing. Contrary to what I learned as a kid, God is not a good policeman. Hmm. It simply did not get confirmed as a base, as a result of my experience, where many terrible people had happy lives, mm-hmm. many wonderful people lost their lives under terrible conditions. I'm still learning. I'm still trying to find answers to some of my questions.
Yeah.
My book appeared in Germany in the German language with the title Wie hat das geschehen können, which means how could it have happened, relating to the Holocaust. I haven't come up with a really good answer to that one yet.
Will you permit one last question?
Please.
What do you think you learned about human nature? Or I'm sure you can't cover all of human nature, but some aspects of human nature that came out in this very dramatic historical moment that you saw both sides of, really.
Well, I've learned not to rely on human nature too much. I often say that when we study the Holocaust, we are really studying human nature. We're not just studying German nature. We're studying human nature, of how people respond to certain conditions, how people act and react under certain conditions. And I do not go along with Goldhagen's claim that the Holocaust was strictly a almost genetic German event. I think I have met many wonderful German people after the war who are very much concerned about what happened during their parents' or grandparents' time in Germany. I lived through, in my earliest life, through a time when Germany was one of the most civilized, cultured nations in the world. And during 12 years while Hitler was in power, everything was turned upside down. And no, it's not just the German personality. I'm afraid it's a weakness, not a tendency, but a weakness in human nature. And I am convinced today that the vast majority of Germans during Hitler's time were not extremely cruel, were not extremely good. The vast majority of Germans were ordinary people leaving ordinary lives and permitting the murderers to do their murdering. And I think that is the biggest problem that was revealed in the study of the Holocaust. How do you get people to fight for their moral beliefs? How do you get people to risk helping their neighbors, helping people who are being unjustly treated? If we could learn to do that, we wouldn't have to worry about the murderers. But the murderers do their work because people allow them to do it, because people see what's happening or realize what's happening but don't want to get involved, turn away from it, want to mind their own business. And that's the danger of today's world, as it was the danger at that time. How do you get people to recognize injustice and to do something about it before it's too late? Mm-hmm. That is a big weakness in human nature, I think.
Well, thank you. I've been speaking with Fritz Oppenheimer. This is Janet Levine for the National Park Service, and I'm signing off.